Neo. Do you know who this is?
Morpheus.
Yes. I've been looking for you, Neo. I don't know if you're ready to see what I want to show you, but unfortunately you and I have run out of time.
What is happening to me?
You are the one, Neo.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus The Matrix Retrospective Series.
Welcome back.
We missed you.
Hosted by Jacob.
You believe that you are special, but somehow the rules do not apply to you.
Stuart.
You got the gift, but it looks like you're waiting for something.
And Arnie.
Never send a human to do a machine's job.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and explicit language.
Are you sure you want to hear this?
Listener discretion is advised.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back.
Why? It'll be fun. I promise.
Today, we're discussing The Matrix, starring Keanu Reeves, Lawrence Fishburne, Carrie Ann Moss, Hugo Weaving, Joe Pantoliano, and directed by the Wachowski brothers. This is Arnie, the digital pimp of Now Playing.
Stuart in L.A.
Whoa, this is Jacob.
Are we doing Bill and Ted?
Hey, let me tell you, that whoa is why I didn't see this when it came out. I saw that trailer and Keanu Reeves like dodging bullets in slow motion and then that whoa. I'm like, oh, fuck this film. This is going to be the dumbest thing. I didn't see it till months later after it came out because of that trailer and that whoa.
Oh, Keanu is in a movie. He's going to say whoa, at least at that point. So, hell, whoa, I still go.
Yeah, but we were late on it too, Arnie. I saw it with you, and we saw it months after it came out. We were not there opening weekend, and I agree. There was a lot that this movie had to overcome. It had to win its cult following. Of course, we're talking about The Matrix, now considered a science fiction classic, but back in 1999, when it came out in the shadow of Star Wars Episode One, with the star of Johnny Mnemonic and several bombs at this point, no, it didn't look like they had a classic on their hands. I was hesitant, and I think a lot of people underestimated how strongly this movie would seize the popular imagination.
Yeah, we saw this in April. It had been out a few weeks. It was pretty new. You'd come back home. We decided to go see this. I had some interest in it. I thought it looked kind of cool. I was working in computers by that point. I was into computer movies. I was watching them all, even though they were mostly shit, like The Net and The Lawnmower Man, which you'll be hearing us review on the main feed. But we went to see this, and yeah, you say The Shadow of the Phantom Menace, and what this was coming out just about 2 months before Episode One was opening, which was supposed to be the science fiction movie of 99. But really, if you look at the cultural zeitgeist these days, I think most people say The Phantom Menace is a bad movie, or at the very least, the worst of the Star Wars films. And The Matrix is held up now as a sci-fi classic.
Yeah, I didn't see this, not just like a month after it came out, I didn't see this till the summer of 99. It was in a dollar theater. The only reason I saw it is my mom's like, oh yeah, it's pretty good. I'm like, my mom likes this like science fiction Keanu Reeves movie. That is not her type of film. There's no Julia Roberts or crying in this film. If she's into this science fiction thing, I gotta check it out. And that's why I finally saw it and I was blown away. But I didn't even know many people that had seen this film or know many that were talking about it. It wasn't till maybe the next year where I think it really started getting a following once it hit video.
Yeah, I think we had to work through the Phantom obsession of the time. I think what surprised me when I realized what had really happened was when the Oscars came out and it took visual effects over George Lucas. I was stunned. I didn't realize that people really had been won over by this. It's not like there isn't some kind of Star Wars going on here. I do think they kind of patterned some of the things on Lucas's world, but in a very cyber hip way. I am, I guess, the closest thing we have to a newbie on this series. I have seen each of the Matrix trilogy exactly once, the first two in theaters, the third on home video. I've never seen the Animatrix. I didn't even know it was feature length. And, of course, none of us have seen the new Wachowski movie coming out, Jupiter Ascending, but I do keep up with the Wachowskis. I did see Cloud Atlas. I did see Bound. I skipped Speed Racer, but I try to make a point of seeing their films. I find them interesting directors. even if I'm not completely wowed with everything they do.
And despite me seeing it so late, after you guys, I guess I am the fan. I saw all the films when they were theatrically released. I've seen The Matrix, of course, multiple times, and the sequels. I have a feeling I may be one of the defenders of the sequels. We'll see when we get there, but it is a series that I find engaging, and it's one that I enjoy revisiting. Of course, I've revisited this first one the most, but those other ones I have revisited multiple times too, though, in the past.
And I think I'm coming into this as a bit of a skeptic. When I first saw it, I enjoyed it, but I do think I had my eyes set on The Phantom Menace, and I remember going out for coffee with Stuart after, and I was not too fond on this film, and I think I also then got involved in some of the backlash with it. I did get pretty excited for it, though. Once this came out on video, I gained more appreciation. I've seen this first one quite a few times. Then the sequels came. I saw each of them once in theaters, opening night each time, and then I haven't thought about The Matrix since. So this is my first time seeing even the original since Revolutions was in theaters.
You know what, I think one of the interesting things is when I was watching the extras, the Wachowski, I guess, siblings now, one of them has gone from male to female, so they're no longer brothers, but they stay relatively quiet. They show up in snippets here and there, but they don't really like to talk about these films because they don't want their view to overtake what people get out of these films. And one of the interesting things on all three films is they have a commentary track for philosophers who like the films and for critics who dislike the films. They want you to get all these different perspectives, and I think they would be happy with what we're going to be doing now. They want people to talk about this. They don't want to be the ones talking about it. They want people to delve into this material and sift it out for themselves. So I think they would approve of what Now Playing is doing. So with that, Arnie, kick it off for us. What are we going to be discussing? Give us a plot.
You want me to tell you about the Matrix, Jacob? The world you think you're living in is an illusion, a carefully crafted virtual reality. The truth is, you're not even really listening to this podcast. You're actually laying immobile in a pus-filled pod on a post-apocalyptic world. This modern day of 1999 you think you're living in is a carefully crafted simulation made by artificially intelligent machines. This is the Matrix. This is what's discovered by Thomas Anderson, played by Keanu Reeves, when, under his hacker name of Neo, he starts to hear murmurs of the ultimate computer system, the Matrix. Soon, Neo finds himself being chased by Agent Smith, played by Hugo Weaving, and other men in black, while also pursued by Morpheus, Lawrence Fishburne, and his lieutenant Trinity, Carrie Ann Moss, who think Neo is ready to learn more about the reality. Giving Neo a special pill, his body awakens sometime near 2199. He learns that around the turn of the 21st century, humanity created artificial intelligence, which led to a war of man versus machine. Humans blacked out the sun, creating nuclear winter, as the machines ran on solar power. The machines retaliated, creating large batteries that would siphon the electricity from human brains to power them. To keep the humans docile, they put the human consciousness in the Matrix. Most humans have been born in these farms, fed by tubes with a data jack in the back of their heads to upload their consciousness to the Matrix. The only remaining human city is Zion, which is underground, warmed by the Earth's core. Morpheus and his team live on the Nebuchadnezzar, a hovercraft that flies around Earth, hiding from the sentinel machines that hunt the humans. But Morpheus believes Neo could be the One, a prophesied savior who would have the ability to remake the Matrix in any way he desired. He trains Neo in a series of simulations, uploading into Neo's brain kung fu and other skills. But when Neo fails to excel at fighting, Morpheus needs to prove that Neo is the One, so they go into the Matrix to visit the Oracle, a future-seeing woman who aids the Resistance. But the Oracle has sad news. Neo is not the One, and a time will come where he will have to choose between his own life and that of Morpheus. But before they can leave the Matrix, the group is betrayed by Cypher, played by Joey Pantoliano. Cypher has had enough of this dystopian future and wants to return to the comfortable life the Matrix offers, so he makes a deal with Agent Smith. Cypher will give up Morpheus in exchange for being put back in the Matrix and made a rich actor. Cypher returns to the real world and kills most of Morpheus's crew, but ship pilot Tank, thought dead, returns and kills Cypher before he can execute Neo. Morpheus is captured by the agents, but Trinity and Neo, the only other survivors, escape. But Neo sees the Oracle's prophecy coming true, so he and Trinity return to the Matrix to rescue Morpheus. Heavily armed, they go toe-to-toe with the agents and rescue their leader, and Trinity and Morpheus return to the real world, but Neo gets trapped in the Matrix, forced to fight Agent Smith. The fight seems to go well, but finally Neo is shot and killed by the agent. Neo then raises from the dead. He is the One, and he can remake the Matrix however he wants. He easily inhabits and destroys Smith, and then returns to the real world just in time for Morpheus to fire an EMP and save the Nebuchadnezzar from Sentinels. And as the movie ends, Neo calls the machine, saying that he will show the humans in the Matrix that anything is possible and continue to fight against the machines. He then takes flight as credits roll. So I think this movie has a lot to talk about in here. There's a lot of symbolism, a lot of heavy-handed naming conventions. I mean, Neo, it's an anagram for One.
Yeah, Trinity. Are we going to have some religious themes here?
I think so. I dare say we will be talking about the religious implications and all of the implications. I want to say, before we get into any of that, 1999 was the year, right, man? That was a year for films. It was something about that millennium tension, but there were all of these crazy, ambitious movies being released with conspiracies. And I felt like Matrix was really only one of just tons of movies that really, we were challenging the material world. We were doing well. You know, I felt like America was thriving and prospering, and we didn't trust it. And this was just one of many movies where we looked at our materialistic lifestyle and said, I don't believe in this anymore.
You know, you guys and Marjorie, you reviewed Fight Club a few weeks back. I think there are a lot of similar ideas. One of the things when I was in college, I ran with this intellectual group and we're all different majors and we get together at like coffee shops. And no, we didn't have berets, but it was that kind of thing where we discussed politics and philosophy. And one guy, he always brought up this film. I always brought up Fight Club. So yeah, there was this feeling going on, this materialism that it just wasn't satisfying and almost this weird new agey, I don't know, spirituality that people were trying to grasp. Maybe something primal like Fight Club, or maybe something, you know, moving into the future like we're going to discuss with The Matrix.
Yeah, you know, American Beauty won the Oscar. That was definitely a movie that had a lot of critical thought about suburbia and middle class life and, you know, Magnolia. I don't know what all the frogs had to do with anything, but crazy conspiracy. X-Files was on TV. Dark City, Truman Show, Your Whole Life is a Reality TV Program. I really do feel like we have been building up to this moment. Matrix is the most famous and easy go-to when you want to talk about this idea of what is the nature of reality and our 1999 pre-millennium existence. But it was all over. I mean, I definitely feel like that was my first response to watching The Matrix, was that, wow, I liked the movie, but didn't I just see it last week? Wasn't this Existence? Wasn't this Dark City? Wasn't this Truman Show?
Yeah, I definitely got some Dark City vibes off this, which I'd also seen. And I think that was part of the reason why I didn't go and see this opening weekend, was it did kind of have a been there, done that feel, but it also had something these other films didn't. Kung Fu. This is the action version of that. I mean, even Fight Club, for all the fights it had, didn't have the eye candy, the action film spectacle that this has. I mean, let's keep in mind, this is a Joel Silver film. Lethal Weapon, Joel Silver.
One of the things the Wachowski brothers did call out, they did kind of a written intro, and they said, hey, why do action films have to be idealists, and idea films are typically actionless? They wanted to take those two things and combine them, and yeah, there's a lot of Eastern influence in this film with all the kung fu. I really like that. I go back to The Karate Kid, and I love kung fu films. I'll have a lot to say when we get to those scenes here, but this is a kung fu film. I feel it has a very John Woo Hong Kong action film influence and the shootout scenes, and they go big, but they don't hide away from a lot of the ideas that an action film, a Joe Silver film, might usually hide away from.
My memory was that it was a film that was split. There's so many dualities in the film, but that the film itself was split, that the first half of it was kind of a, yeah, Cronenbergian or Philip K. Dickian sci-fi musing on what's real and what's imagined, and then it, yeah, became a crazy kung fu movie. I'm not the action guy. I wasn't on Karate Kid, and I don't watch John Woo movies, so that was always probably why I never returned to The Matrix. I just remember disengaging with the second half of this movie. Coming back to it, I'm wondering if it's going to feel like a more integrated whole here. I'm reminded of The Good and the Bad when we get going. The opening scene introduces us to the world and to Trinity in Bullet Time.
Bullet Time. I remember it being used in a car ad before The Matrix.
Yeah, twice. This movie did not invent Bullet Time. It was in Gap ads, and it was in Wing Commander, of all things.
But this became so revolutionary for video games. I remember I was big into gaming around this time, and seeing all of these games take it on. Max Payne, which eventually got its own movie, seemed to be the biggest ripoff, including Bullet Time in it. This was huge at the time to have this kind of CGI effect. And I do think this is one of the first times we see CGI integrated in such an action-y way to really enhance the cinematography and change the angles and things like this that we'd gotten thus far.
Yeah, I haven't seen Wing Commander. I don't remember the Gap ad. I don't think they used the same technology that they did for Bullet Time here. I remember it must have been the Super Bowl, because that's usually the only football game I ever watch. But like the year after this came out, like this NFL, like they set up the cameras everywhere so they could do that Bullet Time effect and throw a pass and freeze it and then switch the angle around. Like, hugely influential. So influential that, like, I'm sick of Bullet Time. Like, once I saw Shrek and they were doing Bullet Time in Shrek, I'm like, all right, time to move on.
A lot of bad movies came out of this. I gotta say, maybe I hold it against The Matrix, but for all of its great ideas, it also is responsible for some really crappy movies. Yeah, like Max Payne. That's a horrible film. But yeah, if it wasn't the very first to do it, it certainly is the one that gave it the name. It's Bullet Time because Keanu Reeves will later lean backwards and outmaneuver bullets themselves. I mean, what the process is, as far as my understanding is that there are cameras everywhere, and so when it freeze frames, they're able to take that same frame in a different camera and keep moving around them 360, if you were, so that you're seeing the very same second from all different perspectives.
Yeah, I mean, there is some CGI involved too, because there's gaps when they have all those cameras going off. Like that Bullet Time scene, I think there's like 120 cameras that were all going off at once, and they use CGI to build models and just fill in those gaps that your eye won't really recognize as a CGI Keanu, but it'll just make it run smoother.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very cool effect when used in this way, and I do remember that being my very first thought when seeing this, is that that was something completely unseen. I mean, imagine if they'd taken the current 3D and done this with it. I mean, these things would be floating into your face and doing it. The visual here, the visual style, I'll say the Wachowskis have a great one. I like watching what they make. Stuart, you said you're interested in their films. I've stopped watching them just because I find most of their plots to be utter shit, but I really like their visual style from everything from Here to Speed Racer.
Yeah, this film is actually beautiful looking. Like, if you don't have a Blu-ray player, get one to watch this film, because it is beautiful. Like, just the lighting and the photography, the way it's shot, it's, regardless of the plot or anything else that happens, it's freeze on any frame and it looks great.
Even I, who doesn't like action, I get a little jump in my heart when Trinity goes running up the wall. I do like it when we feel like the laws of gravity don't apply. I think that that's an exciting feeling whenever any movie can kind of do that. I like it more in Wire Fu, because it's usually actors really in the space as opposed to being computer photoshopped onto something. But no, I can go with this aesthetic for the most part. It's not my thing. And I want to put it out there, I'm not in love with this as much as you guys, but it's a good opener. It grabs you.
Yeah, I'll say, when I first saw this, not knowing what I was getting into, all I knew was that, whoa, that I saw in the trailers. Seeing Trinity, she does this crane kick, it freezes, does the Bullet Time, and then she runs up that wall. I'm like, what am I watching? Like, yeah. What is going on? I had no idea if this was just stylistic kung fu choices or is this reality, are the physics different here? It instantly got me into this film.
I had no idea that we would learn everything we were seeing was artificial. So I presumed, coming off Dark City and all of that, that we were seeing an environment where some people had magical powers. I thought that it was a cult. It was a conspiracy. There were some people that can do this kind of gravitational kung fu, and Keanu Reeves would learn that. I think that's what I thought in these opening moments here. But it's very clear that there's a supernatural element both to Trinity and to her pursuer, Agent Smith. I noticed this time he's catching her. The very first shot of the movie is actually the computers trying to track the phone call. It's an unsecure phone line in February 19th, 1998, where Trinity's talking to Cypher. The reason why Agent Smith is able to find her in the Matrix in this hotel is because, what, Cypher had that line open to the computers?
I don't think that Cypher was turning against them at that point. I think that he goes completely anti much later. I just thought it was an unsecured line and they're monitoring everything. They're like the NSA.
You know, that's how I took it when I first saw the film, having watched it repeatedly. It's Cypher talking at the beginning to Trinity. I gotta take it that he's turned already. I mean, finding these agents and hooking up with them, and all this seems like it would take time. Not enough time that we see in the film. So I do read it as you do, Stuart, that this is Cypher letting Trinity be traced, that he's already selling them out.
Yeah, not to get too far ahead, but what we'll learn, we don't even see these characters, their voices, but because I can recognize them now, a repeat viewing. Yeah, one of them is going to be the Judas, as it were. And so I think that when we see that Judas moment, that could have been a flashback. That could have happened years or months before. It could have happened prior to this phone call. He could already be working for them, working towards their goal. Maybe not. Or maybe they just, yeah, monitor everything, and if you stay on the line long enough, they will find you. But that's the kickoff here, is a mysterious phone call about the One, and suddenly Agent Smith is chasing Trinity across buildings.
And Agent Smith, Hugo Weaving, we talked about him not too long ago with V for Vendetta. I didn't actually expect we'd be talking about him again so soon.
He's kind of a Wachowski standby. He was in Cloud Atlas as well. I don't know if he's in Jupiter Ascending.
Smith, for me, he steals the show here. I think he's a great villain. I love the way he talks. He has just this stilted, like everything is exact.
Every T gets ticked and every S is said. I was trying to kind of fake that in the intro here. I just love the way he speaks and the fact that all the way through, he calls Neo Mr. Anderson. Just love him.
I don't know Hugo Weaving. I know that he's beloved. I think it must come from this. All I know is all of a sudden he was a star, and it seemed like out of nowhere. And yeah, I'll go with this role. He's definitely got a hard job of trying to be memorable while playing a character who is anonymous in some ways. You know, he's hidden behind sunglasses. He's surrounded by a lot of people that look just like him. It's hard to stand out when you're basically playing that kind of role, but he does. We definitely identify him early. I think it's good that it's the first scene. We identify him early as the guy to be worried anytime he walks on screen.
There are these two other agents, but I don't know. There is something about his face. I don't know, something about his jaw or the way, maybe because the way he's enunciating everything, it makes his mouth go in a certain, there's something where he stands out where those other two, I was wondering if they're twins half the time because they did look so similar, but his face is just different enough to stand out, and the way he talks just different enough than the other agents to stand out as the one to be wary of.
And Trinity's scared too. She knows enough. I love the moment where she jumps across and smashes through a window, falls down the stairs, and her first reaction is to draw two guns and point backwards because she knows any second that bastard could be on her like that. I mean, he isn't, but the fact that she would respond in such a way lets you know that it's going to be quite a fight when these two get together.
Yeah, because the whole way this film is set up at the beginning, you know, they play the whole cops and the FBI and we're taking this over, it's not your jurisdiction anymore, and then all of a sudden this weird kung fu starts happening. It really throws you off, like, who is the good guy here? Who is the bad guy? I like when you're just thrown into the middle of a film, you know, going back, you brought up Star Wars, you know, A New Hope, you got two robots walking around a spaceship in the middle of a fight. And I like that. I like just that sense of urgency. And you get that here. All this action's going on and just these little things like Trinity pulling the two guns and like telling herself, get up and run, get up and run. Okay, this dude's super dangerous. That's coming after her. There's a lot of exposition in this film, but we don't start with it, which is nice.
I like also how, like you mentioned, Jacob, when Smith comes in, he says, I wasn't telling you not to send in the cops because of her. I was telling you not to send in the cops because we were trying to protect your men. We start off by seeing Trinity as dangerous, breaking these cops' arms and kicking their ass. So when Smith is a threat to her, you know how dangerous these agents really are.
And this was a kickoff, right? This was before Laura Croft. This is before Eon Flux. This is before Kill Bill.
Well, after Eon Flux, the cartoon. I mean, that was 92.
Well, the cartoon. Yeah. But you know what I mean. This really was, I think, the movie that had Hollywood thinking people could accept women as ass kickers. Here's somebody, Carrie Ann Moss. I had no idea who she was. A model, I think, is where she, or the world she comes from. Was she an actress prior to this? I know she'd later appear with Joe Pantoliano in Memento, but I never had seen her before this movie, and she completely owns the screen. I guess we do underestimate her. We think, oh, she's just some pretty chick in a outfit, and after this opening scene, we know she's a badass, and I think she's done a lot for female action stars.
I only knew her from the Melrose Place spinoff Models Incorporated.
Of course you did. I assumed no crane kicks. In that one.
I don't know if she was a real model. I actually think she's an actress. I don't think she's that attractive. I don't think she's model good looking. She's kind of manly. I mean,
well, she's a beautiful woman, but models have to have a unique something about them.
Well, she has a uniquely masculine jawline.
Okay.
Yeah, she did a lot of TV before this, but yet there is something masculine about her. I do see her as a hard character. You know, she's always in black, shiny leather. She's not someone that looks real cuddly. On the other hand, though, I do think she is very feminine. She's sleek and slender, but there is a hardness about her, which is something that you wouldn't expect. I don't even think today it's very popular to have that kind of female hero.
She's not your typical love interest, which is the role she's playing in this. The Wachowskis, when casting, went with someone who looks like she really could be an ass kicker instead of being the most gorgeous woman they could find for Keanu to fall for.
Yeah, and normally they have to work up for it. I mean, we've definitely seen ass-kicking women before. Sigourney Weaver, Linda Hamilton, James Cameron is known for this. But the point is, we usually have a movie of them being softer, of being victimized before they get that edge. Here, it's thrown in our face, and we accept it. We want it. We cheer her. I really think in many ways she is the icon of the movie. Maybe more than Keanu? I guess that's debatable.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. I think it did open a door for those other movies that you mentioned in the early 2000s. I think the star of this is Keanu. I mean, I think that at this point, he was a big enough name to lead this. I mean, I always saw him as somebody who had peaked for me in the 80s until The Matrix came up. I mean, I loved him in Parenthood. I loved him in the Bill and Ted films. The second one, not so much.
You're skipping a big one. He had a resurgence as an action guy with Speed, but that was 94. This is 99. It's been 5 years of bombs in between.
Hold on. I like The Devil's Advocate, so I'll give him that one.
Still a bomb.
Did that bomb? I didn't
realize. It was middle of the road. They didn't make another one. Let me put it that way. But it wasn't Chain Reaction or Johnny Mnemonic.
Oh, God. And I saw both of those and oof, painful. And I think, honestly, it was the stink of Johnny Mnemonic that I felt all over The Matrix.
Well, sure. It's another cyberpunk thriller. I mean, why wouldn't you be trepidatious of Keanu trying to be a computer literate? He's never been someone that projected a great deal of intelligence. Now, I don't know Keanu Reeves, and he may be Mensa material, but by playing surfer dudes and slackers, he really was typecast as someone that was brawn and no brain.
Here's the thing, though. There's a joylessness to Keanu, like Bill and Ted films, Parenthood. He's the party dude. He's happy. And even though he's played these slackers in other films, he's become so bland. And I don't know, maybe they like that because we could all project ourselves into him. Maybe there's something to do with his biracial makeup. Like he could just kind of go in between. And he looks more feminine in this film. You know, his face is much softer than Carrie Ann Moss. There's almost something that he is so blank. And I feel like he plays that a lot, but something, he is so blank in this film that we could all project ourselves into him. as Neo.
You think? I don't know that I see that here. I could definitely see that in his early roles, but by this point, I see him as playing constantly somebody with a chip on his shoulder. I think that as an actor, he's trying to not be Surfer, and so what you end up getting is kind of this laconic, it almost, he's trying to go the other way and he comes back full circle.
That's the thing, he still comes off Surfer, but it's just not as much joy now.
Yeah, exactly. It's like he's lost the fun of being Bill.
He was Ted.
Oh, whatever. The fact that to this day they're talking about making a reunion of that, I'm like, what would that be? But it certainly isn't where he is here. But that said, I don't necessarily see him as, yeah, the super hacker that he is playing, where by day he's working at a Microsoft-like corporation.
What's he doing at night? I know that some punks come by and he gives them a couple of mini discs, but hacker, I'm not really sure what, we don't need to know. We just know that he's a rebel, but I don't get what he's doing on the side to make his money.
Again, with as much exposition as we're going to get, I'm glad they just kind of leave it at, he's a hacker and here's some program that he did for this guy and he's getting $2,000. It must be a really special program. He must be a good hacker. I don't know if I need a lot of jargon about what he's doing here.
Oh, none. Yeah, I don't want it. But it helps because it allows me just to accept that he is a closet rebel. That's all we really need to understand. He may have sold out. He may be working for the man, but he has a dual life. This movie is filled with dualities. Here's the first of many of them. At night, he becomes who he really is, Neo.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting when we first see him, he's, you know, Morpheus is going to be searching for him, but he's, it looks like what, his computer is doing an auto search and looking up Morpheus, where he heard some lines that Morpheus is this world famous hacker, and so he's looking for him.
Yeah, I assume that is just Trinity. I don't know why the computer's talking to him, but we know it's not the Sentinels. It is Morpheus or someone on the team.
It was Trinity.
Yes, right. And she, to seal the deal, rather than to type it all out because she got in trouble last time for being on the phone too long, she sends the White Rabbit, or a woman with a White Rabbit tattoo, one of many Alice in Wonderland references, to go pick him up.
Now, I don't think she sends them. I think because they can see the Matrix, they can sit at their computer and see that awesome screensaver. We all had that screensaver, right? I mean, that was just kick-ass, the green characters going down. And they can see what the Matrix is. They know that a girl with a White Rabbit is coming, and so she knows already where the White Rabbit is going, and so she can be there waiting for him. But I didn't get, like, she was a contact of these people and sent them to Neo's apartment to pick up that disc.
Oh, no, I took it as the lady with the White Rabbit was part of this rebel group. After Neo says, "Nah, I'm not going to go with you guys," she kind of turns so he could see the tattoo on her and says, "Come on." And then he sees the tattoo and decides to go. So I took it at least she is part of this rebellious group with Morpheus.
But we never see her again.
Well, we're going to learn there's lots of groups.
Yeah, she's definitely a plant. And what we learn is that Trinity is known in the Matrix as a real human being. Trinity is a hacker. And Neo knows her by reputation. She apparently hacked the IRS or something like that. There's a throwaway line about that. So what I presume is she's just in good with all of the other hackers. These are rebels. These are the new kinds of punks. And so she probably knows White Rabbit in that capacity alone. I don't think that she has been pulled out of the Matrix. I don't think that they've, you know, have her back in the real world in Zion. But I think that they're friends here in the Matrix as fellow hackers.
See, I didn't really give that a whole lot of thought. I thought, again, that it was just she knew how things were going to go. She could see kind of the future by looking in the Matrix. I was far more focused on the guy buying the disc, Troy. If you go back to one of our really early podcasts, Back to the Future, I was kind of hard on that movie for being overly clever in its writing about how every line becomes a joke. Hey, here, Troy not only says hallelujah, and not only says to Neo, "You're my savior," he has to continue going on to say, "My own personal Jesus Christ," and then say, "You don't exist, you need to unplug." Every line Troy says is about the Matrix.
I get what you're saying, Arnie, and I get that now that I've rewatched this a bunch. The first time, I didn't get it. I didn't take it as clues. I just took them as throwaway lines. I don't know. I kind of appreciate that. I don't think it's done to the same effect as those Back to the Future films, but I get what you're saying.
Well, there is something about the writing in this Matrix trilogy that I remember very strongly, that, yes, people tend to speak in broad strokes, that when they're saying one thing, they're really talking about something much larger in scope. I remember that being a bigger problem in the sequels, and we can talk about it as we go on. But yes, they are introducing very heavy here at the beginning that Neo is to be thought of in the same way as Jesus Christ.
But yeah, I mean, on the first watching, Jacob, I agree with you, it seems like nothing. On a second watching, it's like, oh, yeah, that's clever, because Neo's going to become Jesus. By the time you're watching this a third time, it's like, God, did they leave nothing subtle? I mean, one of them would be cute, but when you have all this dialogue and the fact that he's saying you need to unplug and the only way to fly, it's just so much right there that's going to come into this movie. I think it's too clever by half.
How old is Keanu in this movie? Is he Christ's age? I feel like he could be, at any rate. He's definitely in his early 30s. They go even further here. He's looking for him, capital H. There's this him character that he's searching for. So it is like Jesus before he recognizes his ultimate destiny.
I do think it's interesting that the Wachowskis, you know, again, they're pretty quiet. They don't speak a whole lot. I don't know a whole lot about them, but, you know, knowing that one had a sex change, I think that would be frowned upon and with most Christians. It's weird that there's so much overt Christianity here, that they go for such a strong Jesus vibe. You know, it's not just that this is a religious group, more or less, you know, especially when you get to Orpheus, he is like a cult leader, but that it's such a strong Christian vibe going on for so much of this, talking about the one, and if we're going to get crucifixes later on in the sequels. It's, I don't know. I'm not sure what to make of that, because I think on one hand, they would say that mainstream religion is a matrix. It's something there binding your mind. But on the other hand, here is a religious cult. Here is a religious figure that is going to free us.
I don't take this as religion, honestly. I look at this and the way it's taking the Jesus story as kind of a Joseph Campbell hero's journey type of thing. Yes, they're telling a Christ story, but they're not telling a story of religion and that kind of morality type of thing. It's more about divinity, faith, and spirituality versus actual organized religion, is how I take it.
Yeah, they're not preaching that we should all go read the Bible.
No, they're preaching we should unplug from the Matrix. I mean, yes, it's not the Bible, but there is preaching going on. There is a cultish aspect to this group.
I don't think that they're preaching at us. They're not trying to get us to all go read a Bible. I feel like they're, you know, using a very popular story that many people know and using that to a new effect, to bring it to the cyber world. Tron did it first, but I think they're doing it a little bit better.
Yeah, they're not trying to get us to read the Bible. They're trying to get us to go to S&M Club. And I think that's a religion I could join.
If they play White Zombie, I'm sure Arnie will go.
Is it me or is Rob Zombie the Kenny Loggins of the millennium? I honestly felt like around 2002 that I owned his greatest hits just one song per CD. This, Jeepers Creepers, Daredevil, he's on so many soundtracks. But yeah, it was a wonderful futuristic music back then. Now it's just what I hear in strip clubs.
So why doesn't Trinity take him then? Why does she let him go into work the next morning where he could potentially get captured by Agent Smith?
I think, here's my out of story reason. Arnie, you brought up Joseph Campbell. This is almost Campbell, Hero of a Thousand Faces, to a T. You know, here's the young man, the old wizards trying to send him on a journey. He's got to fail first. He can't just go straight and discover what the Matrix is. He's going to have that journey where he fails. I think there is an aspect of the Matrix, if you're going to free your mind, it has to be your choice. I think that's really what one of the strong themes of this film is. Whether we're predestined or not, there needs to be an aspect of choice in there. And so it just can't be like, hey, let me take you to Morpheus. It's just like, you got to come to this realization yourself.
That's too presumptuous to say, I'll take you to Morpheus. They have to do this whole thing about mailing him a phone.
And you see, I thought they didn't know that Smith was that close to Neo, and they were just thinking they had more time. But again, I take it as sitting there watching this Matrix screensaver, they can see everything. So when Smith shows up, they were almost able to, again, kind of Bill and Ted, go back in time and mail the phone so that it would arrive at that moment.
Yeah, Trinity does say they're watching you. So maybe they couldn't take them at that time. They had to wait till the agents weren't around. They weren't monitoring him as heavy.
Yeah, I think we just wanted to have another cool scene about duality and choice. We see him called in front of his boss, and he gives him a choice about, do you want to work here or not? And then he has a choice about listening to this strange voice on a cell phone that just got dropped off, or to do the noble good guy thing and go with the authorities that have some questions for him. I don't blame him. I wouldn't get up on the scaffolding either.
Well, Jesus, why would he even go out on the ledge? I could not remember the scene, but I'm like, he's going to get captured, right? Because nobody's going out that window. And then he goes out the window, and I'm thinking back to Cat's Eye and the ledge. And this is done far better than that film. And then he gets out there, and then he turns back around. Once you're out there, you're going, I think. I think that turning around is every bit as dangerous as just trying. The other thing I'm like is, put the fucking phone in your pocket. You need two hands for this. And then he drops the phone.
Mr. Anderson. I do like that, again, we get two choices. You live two lives. One that has a future, one that is imagined. It's true. It's not the way that we think it is at this moment, but what he's saying is absolutely true.
It's such a weird fucking scene, because at this point, despite the ninja moves, we've never seen anything like horror, Nightmare on Elm Street kind of thing. And this almost becomes a Nightmare on Elm Street moment when Neo doesn't agree, Smith takes away his mouth and then shoves a robotic insect in his navel. I mean, and then he wakes up and he thinks it's all a dream. That is not like anything else we see anywhere in this movie. The fact that Smith can just overwrite your body parts and things, that would have been a very cool power to pull out later in the movie if he really had it.
Yeah, I think there is an aspect of, once you know you're in the Matrix, maybe you can control that a bit better, that whatever powers these agents may have over taking over your body, because we see them taking over bodies throughout the film. Well, why don't they just take over Morpheus' bodies or Trinity's body? Maybe, again, there's not an explanation. That's me just philosophizing on what's going on here. But I have to say, again, going back to the first time I watched this film, when I saw Trinity do that spin kick, I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And then this is that second what the fuck moment. Like, what am I watching? Like, yeah, because it turns into this horror film with this bug and the mouth melting. And it's, again, they try to play it off. Maybe it's a dream. I didn't think that. But I love the way this film just sucks you in. You never really know what's going on. The first time you watch this really is a mind fuck of a movie.
Yeah, it felt like it belonged more in Cronenberg's existence than it did here. It is the one note that feels completely out of tune with the more actiony vibe. I mean, up to this point, I feel like this is a story in which we'd want to project ourselves and to be Keanu Reeves and to enjoy this journey. Here, things are happening to him that we would never want to endure. And it's unsettling. I appreciated how off balance it made the film. But yeah, they don't go here again, so maybe it should have been cut. I'm not sure what the point of putting a bug in his navel is if the next scene they're just going to get a vacuum tube and suck it all out.
And it comes out with this huge bloody chunk, and it looks like his skin is really torn, but then nobody bothers to bandage the wound. So I think that maybe it would have gotten him an R rating, but I would have liked to have seen exactly more about this bug.
This was R-rated.
Oh, it was?
Yes.
Well, then I really wanted to see more about this bug wound.
That wound is actually a scar he has on his stomach. If you notice that big, like, incision on there.
Oh.
It didn't happen from the... Well, maybe it happened from the bug in this film, but...
Yeah, I think they just had to write themselves out of him being captured, and they want to get Morpheus, but it is too easy that Trinity knows he's bugged and is able to get it out so quickly.
It's handled in such a way that you wonder, why bother? Why didn't we go from the nightclub to meeting Larry Fishburne?
No, he was Lawrence by this point.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, he'd become Lawrence for quite a while. I knew him as Larry. I loved him as Larry. I always get a little mad when he'd want to go by Lawrence.
He had had a real resurgence in the 90s. He had come up with Boys in the Hood and was really known for having these dramatic turns. It's not surprising that he would play this role here. You know he's a good guy, but I gotta say, watching again this time, I'm just thinking Count Dracula. Count Dracula, the thunderstorms and walking around these 19th century parlors. I don't know why anyone would take a pill from him. He's creepy as hell, but because he's Larry Fishburne, I'd take the pill.
Yeah, I'd taken the pill because some of his dialogue, a lot of this dialogue shouldn't work. Like, if you're reading this script on paper, there is some corny dialogue here, but when Fishburne's saying it, I'm buying it. Like, it's not corny. I'm like, oh, totally into it. Yep, this is the Matrix. This is the reality. Yeah, this is totally true.
He has a great delivery here, and it's almost like Agent Smith's, but a little bit more arch. And so when I think about this, I'm trying to decide, is this something the Wachowski brothers really put in their actors, or is it something that both came to? The Wachowskis, they'd only directed one film before this, and that was Bound, which I enjoy for all the wrong reasons. But I'm trying to figure out, is this intentional that they're creating these arch rivals here and all of this cadence that Fishburne is speaking in? It works for me, but it certainly is not naturalistic.
No, there's very little about this film that actually feels naturalistic to me. It does feel so mythological. I mean, in The Matrix, everyone's got their code names, but I guess it's not just in The Matrix, because they call each other those names in the real world, too. Like, everyone's acting like they're in a comic book or a superhero.
It's hacker mentality, Jacob, and I touched that world a little bit. Your hacker name is your real name. Your birth name's your slave name.
I do think there is an aspect to that. When we see this group, Morpheus gives him the pill and he walks in and there's this group of people. And when we'll see it in the other films, when we see Zion, it's a very multicultural group. Like, usually you're used to a bunch of white dudes and like one black guy. Here, there is a good mix of male, female, all different races. I think there is an aspect like, yes, if you were stuck in this fake world, I think non-white people would want to get out of it. It hasn't been great for them. I think they would be more likely. So I do like there is so much multiculturalism. And I think that's one of the Wachowskis' messages here is, you know, not just bringing this tough female Trinity action hero, but really having a multicultural cast going on.
I would take it one step further. I think maybe the reason why these people got out of the Matrix is because they could never totally buy into it, because they are considered a minority in this world, because they don't get to the level where they're consumed by their material possessions. I think it is a statement on race relations in 1999. Originally, I do know that they wanted Will Smith for this part. I think that message might have been even heavier if they had had Will Smith instead of Keanu Reeves. Although he's too cocky for me. I couldn't imagine him ever self-doubting himself. But we are all building to the big twist here. This is the end of Act 1. We, up to this point, still think that we're just in a noir movie where cyber people are taking on nefarious agents. There's one little touch that I love about the cinematography. You notice how everything is green here?
Yes.
It suddenly occurred to me it's the same tint of green that all the computer monitors were of that time. I mean, that was my computer monitor. Before there were color monitors, there was this stupid, what would you call that green? Cyber green is what I call it.
I would like to say for historians, there were color monitors in 1999, but yes, in the 80s, this was that green.
Yeah, well, that's, I guess, what I'm thinking about. And I wasn't an early adopter. I didn't have the latest and the greatest. I still had a green monitor, maybe until about 96. But my point is that they're really telling us, even through the visual style of this movie, that there is an unnatural, sickly, greenish quality to this world. That we should be prepared by the time that he takes the red pill and goes to Wonderland, what's about to happen. But were you? Would you have guessed that this is where the movie was going in Act 2?
No idea. When he takes that pill and gets hooked up to the machine, and again, that mirror melts and covers him up and you get that great modem type scream.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? What the fuck is going on here?
Yeah. Although they mix their metaphors. Up to this point, it's all been Alice and rabbit holes, but then Cypher's got to go and say, buckle your seatbelt, Dorothy. Kansas going bye-bye. Yeah. That's the wrong children's story. Get it right, Cypher. I'm glad you got kicked out.
Yeah, he is a traitor, so he's trying to throw off the metaphors, trying to confuse everyone.
Maybe that was the first clue. He didn't get the right book.
Yeah, I don't remember back then if I knew going in what the secret was or if this was a total mind fuck. But like you said, Stuart, there were so many of these your reality is not real kind of movies that I just think that I thought this was cool. I mean, again, I kind of go to Lawnmower Man. I mean, it was all VR.
I don't want to go to Lawnmower Man, but I guess we are in a couple weeks. We'll see how much it compares. But this is happening long after that. And it's actually my favorite part of the movie, then and now. But the whole rebirth and the scenes that follow it that kind of explain what happened between artificial intelligence and mankind, I really think are the strongest. The ideas. What I still respond to most about The Matrix is not the crane kicks, is not the bullet time. It's the idea that this could be the future between man and machine.
I think the symbolism's a little bit heavy-handed, that he wakes up, he basically bursts through some kind of placenta, he's covered in fluid, and then he actually gets flushed through a tube. I mean, he's birthed. out of this thing.
Although he's actually being flushed away. I mean, he's a screw up. He's being flushed so that he can drown when he gets to the bottom here. He's not being given life. He was given life by the rebels who gave him the pill to make him wake up. But the little machines, they consider him a defect. They're getting rid of him. They're unhooking him from the metallic umbilical cords so that he can go drowned.
I mean, yes, that is the machine's method, but by the same token, you're unhooking an umbilical cord and he's going down a long tube. So no matter what the machine's trying to do to him, it is a birthing. It is him being born into this new world.
Right, yeah, he is becoming Neo. I mean, that will be the journey for Act 2, is him accepting that, yeah, he is Neo. He calls himself Neo sometimes, but he really doesn't embrace that as who he really is until the end of Act 2. And it starts here, obviously. And as you say, very heavy-handed. Too heavy-handed? I don't know. I guess it's personal taste. But I like that we're seeing a literal birth as he's introduced to this crazy, real world.
Yeah, I'm putting myself back in that 1999 mindset, much less educated, not the history with movies that I have now and literature. This seemed like I could grasp this. I could, okay, this is rebirth. You know, now watching this, I'm like, oh, this is so obvious. Oh, he's being called my personal savior, and then he's going to be Jesus. But I think for younger people when this came out, or even someone younger watching it today, I think that is one of the nice things about it. It is this cool action film where they do cool flying kicks, but it does have these ideas, and they're put in a way where you could grasp it. Now, if you're older and you've seen this stuff 100 times, it's not as fresh, but for the right audience, and I think this hit the right audience when it came out, it does seem very fresh. It does seem very exciting and something that you could understand and like, oh, neat, I could see symbolism here.
Yeah, subtext doesn't have to be subtle. I mean, sometimes that's nice, and sometimes it's nice that everyone gets it. Everyone that's going to watch this is going to get, on some level, I have to believe, as he's being yanked up into the Nebuchadnezzar, you know, holding his arms outstretched, that he is being saved and being reborn, and that, yeah, we will essentially see a Christ story. You may not get all of the little nuances and ways that they tell it, but we're understanding that this is a Messiah story.
But I do like the visuals a lot, and yeah, I think, Stuart, you mentioned Cronenberg. This scene feels really Cronenberg to me. The mixing of machine, all those metal tubes, the pus, the shaved head, the whole thing just really screams Cronenberg to me.
Yeah, it screamed aliens to me, too. It's very biomechanical.
Alien 3 specifically, the bald heads, I think it was, and the cinematography.
Jacob, you did all the bonus materials. I have to ask, because I wonder this. Did they film, like, all the hair scenes first and just hope that all their takes were good and keep a wig around just in case a pickup was needed, and then do all the shaved head scenes and then all the stubble scenes?
They didn't go into that detail. I know this birthing scene was one of the last ones they did. Keanu actually lost 15 pounds for this scene. He had put on all this bulk for when he was Kung Fu Computer Jesus. And so he wanted to look, you know, like he'd been living in a tube. So he actually lost 15 pounds for this final scene that they shot of him being birthed out of the tubes.
So I get a lot of the symbolism. I have not looked this up. I don't know. What's a Nebuchadnezzar?
So this is the interesting thing. Nebuchadnezzar, because we've gotten all these Judeo-Christian vibes so far with, you know, this idea of a Messiah. Nebuchadnezzar, he was the king that I believe destroyed the temple in early Judaism. Like in the Babylonian king, you know, before thousands of years before Jesus was around, but when they were set up as a nation, this is someone that came in and wiped out the Jewish people.
So how does that fit with the story we're seeing? I'm not getting it.
Yeah, and particularly since they lives in Zion, which, yeah.
You know, I take this as, here's this civilization that's been building off pieces of whatever their history was. Like, they all have these code names, like, oh, I heard, you know, Morpheus. I don't know where that comes from. Maybe it's some Greek mythology, and that's a cool name. And Nebuchadnezzar, there's somewhere that was in the Bible, and that was something that was powerful, so we'll take that. That's how I've always read, like, all these different namings. They've just taken pieces of civilization that they kind of have heard of. They don't remember anymore. They have little pieces of and have rebuilt their civilization based on those things.
You see, Morpheus, I actually know, God of Dreams. I think I might have learned that from Freddy.
That's true. That, yeah, I should have remembered that from the comic book, The Sandman.
And I think that's Greek myth. I mean, there are other religions and thoughts represented. I even think on some level atheism is represented. I'm not sure that you can't watch this movie and not think that this is a delusion. That these people, because they believe that Neo is the one, he achieves what he's set out to achieve. But he, in fact, is not divine in nature. That it's a self-created myth. as opposed to being a true messiah story.
So I want to talk a little bit here about what The Matrix is and the fact that it is just a dream. I mean, I remember taking a philosophy class as a freshman in undergrad college and being posed with this question. What if the universe was just created 5 minutes ago? And you have only lived for 5 minutes, but you were created with the memories of all that you have done before. How would you know? And would it really matter? And that's kind of asked here is, what is real? So if you're all living in the Matrix and you have your own free determination in the Matrix, I mean, how is that any different than what life is? Joey Pantoliano later on makes the choice and says, fuck it, give me the Matrix. I don't see that as necessarily that bad of a choice either.
And I think that is the interesting question that this trilogy will explore more in the sequels is The Matrix really all that bad? I mean, even now, okay, let's assume we're living right now in real life. You know, our senses form a perception. We can't see certain light waves. So what we see is because of the limitations of our eyes, what we hear because of the limitations of our ears. Like, we already live in something that's, it's not reality. It's just what we could perceive. And is that different than The Matrix? If you're a brain sitting in a jar and that's all you can perceive, is that any less real than us sitting at our computers right now talking about this film?
Because it's about control, fellas, and that always gets people's goats. I don't want to be controlled. I mean, Keanu even says that early in the movie. He rejects the idea of fate. Even the notion of fate is something he rejects because he wants free will at all costs. And that's probably why he took the red pill to begin with. We don't want anyone telling us what to do, even when they design a perfect Eden for us. What I love about this is eventually we'll learn out that Matrix 1.0 was designed to be Eden. It was a paradise. It was perfect. But humans couldn't grasp that. We're the screw-ups. We're dysfunctional. There's something about us that's masochistic, and we rejected Matrix 1, so they had to build Matrix 2, which was based on 1999, which is apparently as good as it got for the human race.
Yeah, Rob Zombie.
Which begs the notion of, at some point, does time stop? Do they ever get to the new year, or does it cycle back? I'm not sure how that works if it's always 1999. Maybe it's just the status quo of 1999, but they'll still keep calling it, you know, years in advance. Maybe no one will notice that nothing is progressing. I don't exactly know.
They do say it's 100 years later than they think it was, so they got 100 years to, like, catch up to what they knew before this great war between humans and robots.
No, but it's not been 100 years since, I mean, the war happened, I think, a couple years after this. But yeah, we know that human beings got to the point where they felt like computers were controlling them too much. The artificial intelligence had them running us. Well, that kind of looks like 2014. I'll go with that. But eventually, the human beings realized that if every device is solar powered, we'll black out the stars and the sky. I that's pretty extreme. I would have hate to have been around that day when they thought that was a good idea. Oh, we'll just destroy the ozone. We'll make the skies black. And then the computers won't get any more sun and they'll just stop working. At some point, somebody figured out that human beings are going to be the batteries. Now, I can't take this seriously. This, to me, is kind of amusing. It's crazy, and I appreciate the creativity of this, but this hardly feels like someone stripping the veil off of reality here. I mean, this is a comic book plot. This is kind of silly, right? I mean, this is fun.
More than that, though, this whole thing really feels like Skynet 2.0, right? I mean, you talk about man blacking out the sky and things, man versus machine, the AI becomes self-aware. It's just Terminator, only now we're batteries instead of just hunted.
Well, Terminator wanted to kill us. These guys want to keep us around. They like us. They even recycle us. We get ground up and fed to babies. I love that shot.
Well, they do need us because there's no solar power. I think the Wachowskis even, like, had a hard time swallowing because they're like, you know, our bioelectricity mixed with some fusion, some form of fusion. Like, that's a magic thing in movies. Cold fusion, you know, go watch The Saint if you dare.
Yeah, I think Keanu may have helped create that in Chain Reaction.
Don't remind me.
When I was in college and seeing this, like, yeah, it's kind of corny. It was cool, though, that here's this idea that, you know, this brain in the jar, that's something you do. Arnie, you talked about in philosophy classes. That's something we would discuss. Like, what if you're just a brain in a jar? What if this is a dream? Like, so to come up with some way, I don't know if they're is a better way to come up with that kind of scenario where machines have taken over and they got to keep humans around and create this artificial construct to harvest our energy. If you got a better way, let me know. I think any explanation is going to sound kind of comic booky.
It doesn't seem like a plausible future for us. I'm not worried that this is going to happen to us, but I don't have to be in order to buy into this world. I'm settling in my expectations for just something being outrageous and silly and fun. Some of these conspiracy movies, they really take it seriously. X-Files, I felt like, took it really seriously. Here, it's as serious as it needs to be.
Yeah, I mean, I like it as a conceit, because if you didn't give us that, why would the computers even need us at all? It is comic booky, it's not very realistic, but it does give it the conceit it needs for why it isn't Terminator and trying to just kill us all.
Right, because how are humans repopulating? If we spend all of our time alone in these battery casings...
Test tube babies.
Yeah, they're grown in fields.
Oh, okay. So somewhere some robot is sticking a sperm in an egg.
Yes.
Okay.
What I do find interesting is, you know, why is there so much diversity in the Matrix? To put a finer point on it, why do you look the same in the Matrix as you do in real life?
They throw an answer at you, it whizzes by, but at some point they go into a holodeck. I mean, they call it the construct, but basically it's a void where they can make anything they want to appear. And he does say something about the fact that Keanu has got the haircut that he does and the clothes that he does because it's a latent mental remembrance of who he was before. But no, this is reality. He's not creating this. This is actually who he really was.
He's just creating the nice hairdo.
Yeah.
He has a stylist in the Matrix.
Now, they were toying with the idea that they would actually look different. There's this bleached, short-haired woman named Switch. She was going to be a man when she went into the Matrix. So they were toying with that idea that they would be able to change their physical appearance. They just thought it'd be too confusing for audiences if all the characters had the same names, but they looked different depending where they were.
And meanwhile, Trinity would have been a man, right?
I thought it was going to be pink. Didn't it look like the pop star?
Oh, you Wachowskis and your gender bending.
Yeah, it was evident even here.
But there is one thing that I really like about The Matrix, and I think it's inspired my imagination. Maybe I had it before The Matrix, but The Matrix put a really fine point on it. The ability to upload knowledge. Screw studying, plug it in, upload it, and now I know Kung Fu.
Oh, I love that idea. Here's my question. They don't know Kung Fu in real life, though.
No.
They only know it in The Matrix.
Well, they're uploading it into their brain. So I would think that while he may not be able to do the super moves, that he would have that knowledge. I mean, you learn how to fly a helicopter that's uploaded into your brain. It's just a faster way than doing the practice and everything else. I mean, keep in mind, what you know is merely your experience. If you could have that experience in a blink at the speed of light while it's just put in your brain, then you could do that anywhere, right?
I'm not a fan of the learning chair. They did that shit in Battlefield Earth, too, and I threw tomatoes.
You saw that?
Oh, God, many times.
You're the one.
I'd love to cover it sometime. I got thoughts.
I saw it, too.
But anyway, at least no one eats a rat here. But my point is, I feel like it's an easy way of getting the characters to where they need to be next. We don't want to spend years and years with Keanu learning these things. So, yeah, okay. So they flip a switch, and now he has this knowledge, and he can consume it at a faster rate than anyone else has ever been able to do. That's why they're able to perpetuate this idea that he's special, that he's the one, because he's an absorber of knowledge.
But they could all absorb. Trinity absorbs the helicopter thing. It's not just Keanu.
No, but he absorbs it faster. I mean, Tank at one point says, I've never seen anything like this. I don't know how long these guys have been out of the Matrix, but it took them a lot longer to get to where they're at than where Keanu is in such a short amount of time. But, you know, knowledge is not just things that you know. It's also practice, agility. I mean, can you really learn all of that without actually physically practicing? I guess that's why we have the scene in the dojo, where that's where he gets to show what he's learned.
When we see Neo birthed from the machine, they had to rebuild his muscles. Like, so obviously, yeah, you might know it in your head, but can you really throw those punches in real life?
Right.
But in the construct, I am going to compliment this film. You know, I love Kung Fu, and I swore, I'm like, you know what? They put the actors' faces digitally over actual martial artists here. They do long shots. When you're watching real kung fu, you know it's a great kung fu film when they're long, lingering shots and they're just letting them do their moves. If they're quick, you know, half-second cuts here and there after each punch, those people don't really know what they're doing. Here are long shots of them doing these kung fu fights. I'm like, oh, they must have pasted faces over actual stuntmen. No, they spent 4 months learning this battle, choreographing it out, and, you know, it was almost like a dance. They had to do it step by step and do it exact so they didn't hurt each other too much. But they're actually fighting here, Fishburne and Keanu.
Oh, I'm fully aware of that, because never once did I buy Kung Fu Keanu. It never looks right. I take away every compliment you've given it, Jacob. Keanu never sells me. And when he goes into his fight me pose and does the surfer hang 10 hands, it's ludicrous.
That's the real stances, though. They filmed real martial artists doing this whole fight, and that's what they studied. And these are all the stances that they choreographed out. I mean, they brought in real kung fu choreographers to figure all this out.
Well, Stuart says you can't upload it. I guess 4 months isn't enough either, Keanu.
I give him props for trying.
He did have to get neck surgery, so he couldn't actually do a lot of the moves they originally wanted him to do. His, like, vertebrae were all fused together.
He moves like it.
He tries. I'm
yes,
not
he
fall
tries. He doesn't succeed.
Well, that's the story of his career in large part, but I do feel like I find him more credible than I often do here, and my problems with him is not that he's not convincing in the martial arts. I actually have a bigger problem later when he has to go at it with Hugo Weaving. But I think that's just my mental image of those two actors not jiving with a martial arts film. I didn't know we were going to totally go this route. And I remember why I kind of first blanched. There's only one action scene that I absolutely hate in this movie, and it comes later. But in little moments, in almost every action scene, there's something that makes me kind of groan. I just... It's not my thing. I don't know what else to say. I know that many people love it, and it's cool, and it was cutting edge. But isn't there just something a little silly about it? Maybe it's the costuming. I'm wondering if they didn't have those 80s trench coats, if I might have been more cool with it. But I can't say that I'm loving these action scenes much more than I did back in 1999.
And I'll disagree with you there, Stuart. I'm loving some of the action in this movie. Never in the dojo. Never the kung fu. And they kind of move away from the kung fu a lot. But when Keanu's not involved, I really like it. I like the Trinity opening fight. Later on, when they're storming that building and have the huge gunfight, I really like it. But anytime Keanu is trying to do martial arts is when it just, he doesn't move right. He doesn't look right. I mean, I've watched a lot of Jackie Chan and some other, not as much as Jacob has, but a lot of that kind of stuff. And it is not there. He is no Ralph Macchio.
Yeah, and you know what? I get that. I like that they shot this like a kung fu film. It's not as great as a Jackie Chan or a Jet Li or a Ralph Macchio film. Maybe Karate Kid 3.
Maybe 3, okay.
But, you know, I appreciate that they went totally with that Eastern vibe. There is something with, you know, traditional martial arts films that if you study Eastern philosophy and Eastern religion, it's about freeing your mind, you know, that idea of, you know, nirvana and getting rid of all desires. And you watch Bruce Lee and Enter the Dragon, you know, there's a speech, you know, the best system of fighting is no system at all. I feel like those martial art themes that you see in a lot of those classic martial art films, they fit into this world. And so it's appropriate to go with these martial art scenes. And it's a way of an action way, a fighting way of expressing freeing your mind.
Rightly or wrongly, though, I do enjoy a martial arts film every now and then when I feel like the stunts are really real. I always find them amusing. I don't know if it's intentional, but there's something kind of campy about them. Enter the Dragon or something like that. You know, a guy with fur on his claws. I mean, there's something funny about it. Whereas here, this is a lot of self-serious Zen philosophizing while they're fighting. I rarely see a crack in the smile. I feel like there's a humorlessness and a self-seriousness about the action that makes it harder for me to swallow. Again, particularly will come as a problem when we cut into the third act. That's where I actually have a scene where I just completely out and out reject it. Here, it starts in moments, but I feel that the most unsuccessful part of The Matrix for me is when it goes for these martial arts action moments. And I know that that's not a popular philosophy, but I'm here to say what I think.
See, it's the philosophizing when it kind of loses me. It's a little bit too pop philosophy, a little bit too surface level, and you just kind of got to go with it. And because it's Lawrence Fishburne, you know, nod and say yes.
Later, he's training him on the Sentinels and how they work as gatekeepers. And he makes some line about how they've trained people in the past. They've thought they've had ones before and that they ended up being martyrs. Is he talking about, like, Martin Luther King and Gandhi and all of that? Because I'm going to crack my shit up if that's what he was talking about.
I mean, they do talk about, like, early on, there was the one that freed the first of them and that he was able to, like, change the Matrix and that he's going to come back. I mean, this isn't just a Messiah story. This is the second coming of Christ. Like, was Neo that one that freed him originally? And now that brain matter has been recycled and cloned and come back to create this second version of him.
Yeah, when they talk about the first one, was that recent? Was that like in Morpheus's lifetime, or was that, say, 2,000 years ago?
I took it as being in Morpheus's lifetime.
Yeah, that's how I took it as well. So it wasn't the Jesus.
No, not Jesus Jesus, just a
another Jesus.
I guess this would have been like a 1899 Jesus.
Or no, if it's Morpheus's lifetime, like 1995 Jesus?
No, because this is really happening in 2090 or something like that, right?
I don't know if Morpheus is one of the first freed. I think, you know, maybe his dad's lifetime.
But if somebody could remake the Matrix, then it would have been, you know, a few years before this, assuming the Matrix is on a linear time scheme.
Well, we'll talk more about this with the next film. I think we should table this because it's definitely going to touch upon this when we reload.
Okay, because I can't remember anything about the next two other than some, like, apple pie pussy, so...
I believe it's a chocolate tort, and okay. Yes, she squeeged. I do remember that very distinctively, yes.
That's my only memory, that and a car chase with an albino, so I'm looking forward to it.
Are you? Yeah, I guess I am too. I don't remember much about it, except that, yes, I do remember they talk themselves into circles. Here, I feel like they stop just short of getting over their head here. They're treading water. Sometimes I feel like, yeah, they want to explain everything. They want to create this expansive universe where it all makes sense. And there are just little bumps where they get into trouble, but they know when to shut up. I never really have a problem with it. But I did have to laugh when I thought that, wow, did Gandhi know Kung Fu? Did Martin Luther King, did he pull out these moves before the man put him down?
And this kind of leads to the Oracle, because after Keanu's training, the key is to go visit the Oracle, who is part of the Resistance but lives in the Matrix, and I can't decide if she's real or not. I mean, they say that most of the people in the Matrix are battery humans who their consciousness is in the Matrix. But then you have, like, the agents who are programs. But then you have the Oracle. And is she jacked in from Zion? Is she in a battery tube somewhere? And because she's an Oracle, she's decided not to be released. Is she a program? We get more of her later on, I remember, too.
We'll find out about the Oracle. But I think, you know, when I watched this film, before I ever saw those sequels, my assumption was she was just another person that got freed. Maybe she's jacked in at Zion or another ship. I never took her as anything else but that.
I have to believe, and it's just me thinking about it now, because I didn't ask these questions during the movie, is that if she lives in the Matrix, there must be something cybernetic about her. Otherwise, why not give her a red pill and get her to Zion, where they don't have to risk their lives to go talk to her in her prophecies? She must be integrated in some way with the programming of this world. That's what I'd have to believe, in order for her to know how it all turns out. But then again, she's so damn coy, we never know what she really knows. I ask, because I did know somebody that claimed to read palms and kind of act like this. She just smoked a lot of pot, basically, is what it is. Does the Oracle really know anything, or is she just baking some good marijuana cookies?
I think, you know, she's similar to Morpheus. Morpheus, he believes in this idea of the One, so he spends his life looking and telling all these people, oh, you're the One, and then, you know, eventually one of them's going to believe him, and they'll become the One. I mean, the Oracle, there's that great scene where she tells Neo, you know, don't worry about the vase, and Neo turns and knocks it over, and she's like, well, if I didn't tell you that, would you have done that? I mean, she is guiding people. Does she know things, or is she just subtly hinting for the way people should go?
She seems like the queen of self-fulfilling prophecies.
Yes, self-fulfilling prophecies is a great way to describe this. I think that this is the unanswered question about the Matrix, and that is, was Keanu Jesus Christ, or could anyone have been told this line And if they had it drilled into their head enough, would achieve what he has achieved by the end of it. I don't think we are to know conclusively. I think that it goes back to questions about free will and whether does he have free will here or is he being guided by fate? He hates the idea of being guided by fate, but that's how it looks if you take it as a literal story about a messiah.
Well, I mean, even Morpheus, the Oracle told him he would find the one. So he spent his whole life doing this. Would he care about the one if he wasn't told by some mystic that that was going to be his role?
That said, so much of this movie is about faith. Like, when Neo is being trained, it's being told you have to let go and have faith. You have to believe you can jump over this building, and then you'll be able to. And so, I do think that the way this story is told, that Neo is the one. And it's not that any of those spoonbenders out in the lobby could have been the one if the right belief was there. I do think that because his name is an anagram and all of this, and that he was learning faster than anyone had learned before, he was an adept and everything else, I do think this is his destiny. And what he has to do in this is learn to give up that desire for free will, which is kind of anti what the movie is. The whole thing is we want to have that free will. We don't want to be in this fake world, but yet he still has destiny. He still has a path that he must walk. He could always refuse. He could always refuse the call when Morpheus gets kidnapped. He could always say, fuck him.
That's the thing. He's ultimately told, like, his big palm reading moment is that you're going to have to make a choice. Either you or Morpheus are going to have to die. Like, you're not the one. That's your choice. Who's going to die?
Yeah, what's weird is that neither one of them die, but I guess that maybe that'll be solved in a sequel, but I felt like that was a cheat.
No. It happens here. What the Oracle says, and this one thing is what makes me think the Oracle isn't full of shit. The Oracle knows that Neo's going to have to make a choice between his life or Morpheus's, and he does, and he chooses to sacrifice himself, and Neo dies. He gives up his life. Now, he comes back because he's the one. But he had to make a choice to stay on the Nebuchadnezzar and allow Trinity to yank Morpheus's brain tube and kill him, or to go back in and die himself. He goes back in, he dies.
That's how I read it, Arnie.
I mean, he dies because she stands there at the phone booth yakking too long, and he doesn't get a chance to get out of there, so he has to fight and lose a battle with a gun. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's when he dies.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's more her fault, but whatever. When you say that you have a choice and a sacrifice, I imagined a moment where he took a bullet for Morpheus. And here, it...
We'll get there. Let's talk about Cypher. This is how we get to Morpheus being captured in the sacrifice. Cypher, we see him talking to the agents. I love this scene. You know, for a film that seems so cold and, you know, all this black leather and sunglasses, you never see anyone's pupils. Joe Pantoliano... He gives this some heart. He gives this some warmth. The total bad guy, total dick move. But I love the humor here, and that he does make an argument for the Matrix. Like, instead of eating this white spooge every day, he gets to eat a nice rare steak.
Joe Pantoliano, from Risky Business to Memento to even fucking Daredevil, I love this man. And he is great in here.
He did come up with the Wachowskis. He was in Bound.
Yeah, that's right. He was. That was half of my reason for seeing it. Maybe a third. But yeah, he is wonderful here. I love just the giant, huge bite of steak he has to take that he's chewing for the rest of the scene. I mean, it was that big of a bite.
And in this world that's so, like, green and gray and black, like, I just love how red that meat is.
Yeah, they take away the green tint for this one scene, making you wonder where this is happening, this little interlude with Smith and how he's able to jack in and talk to Smith like this. But yeah, again, I've said it. I'm kind of on Joey's side. Let's just all jack in. It's real enough, right? I mean, I've often said it would be kind of nice to join a religious cult because even if you're just farming herbs for the master all day, if you believe you're happy doing that, isn't that happiness?
This is sinner talk, though. Come on. This is someone that's choosing material pleasure over eternal salvation, right? See, he doesn't want what's real. There's a real salvation that's hard work to get to, but he'd rather have pleasure. He'd rather listen to his body. It's a very Christian fundamentalist notion here that, yeah, he's basically choosing the short term, and because of such, he's damned.
I do find it funny. funny. Like, I didn't notice this till I watched it this time, but Agent Smith, he always calls people like Mr. and their last name. Here, Cypher is Mr. Regan. I'm guessing that's a joke on Reagan because he wants to come back and be an actor.
Oh, or The Exorcist, perhaps. But yeah, you're probably right. It's probably Reagan.
And I just thought it was kind of funny that he wanted to be someone important. An actor.
Yeah, I think it works as that as well. But, you know, we needed a Judas character if this is a biblical story. I'm just surprised there's not 12 people back working on the Nebuchadnezzar for the apostles. They temper it every now and then, but we needed to have a character that was going to betray the cause, and it's a plausible reason for betrayal. What I like about this movie is that they give everything shadings. Even though the machines are quote-unquote evil, they have real reasons for doing what they're doing. This guy has real reasons for betraying the cause, and so because of that, I think it works better. Otherwise, you'd know he's evil just because he has a goatee. They go beyond the goatee. They give you a plausible reason, and I don't hate the character, even though what he does is horrible.
And God forbid they have 12 people back on the Nebuchadnezzar, because we haven't even talked about Dozer, Tank, or Mouse, or Apoc.
And I don't see a reason to now.
No, I mean...
They're pretty much there to pilot the ship, yes, have cool names, yes, and then give us this really dramatic scene where Joey is going to basically systematically unplug them as he has a lover spat with Trinity, who has always rejected his advances.
Did he even make advances? That's what I could never tell. I couldn't tell if he was pining in secret or...
It was there.
You know, we're going to find out that Trinity was told by the Oracle that she would fall in love with the One. And it seems like Cypher knows that. He keeps asking, you know, hey, did you tell him what the Oracle, you know, told you? And so he seems to sense that there's something between Trinity and Neo. And it's almost like there's a jealousy. Like, why didn't she fall in love with him? Because then he could be the one.
Yeah, I think that he feels like if the Oracle had kept her mouth shut and just kept baking cookies to herself, he could have this girl. That this was denied to him because she's living in some crazy notion that a man is going to come that's her savior. And so he doesn't buy into it. Even on the phone, in that first scene, he's the one that does not believe what Morpheus believes. And he's not necessarily wrong. Again, I say, we don't know that Neo is the one. We just know that he fulfills a prophecy. Doesn't mean he was destined for it, though. It just means that he lived up to it.
The Cypher bit gets pretty dark pretty quick. I mean, at first he just wants to go back there and be an actor, but by the time it's over, he's actually killing his compatriots one by one.
You'd think that he'd have a little affection for them. Maybe not Apoc. Nobody knew him. Tank, poor old Tank, at least he didn't really die. I was happy to see at least one of them come back. I guess he's the miracle that saves Neo, because otherwise, how would they write him out of the scene? It really would be impossible for Neo to come back. If he had been unplugged, that would have been the end of it. I mean, no more Messiah.
Yeah, I do think there's something interesting going on here, where maybe it's an ironic, the one, because there are so many aspects to Neo becoming the Messiah. You know, we have Tank, where there's this miracle where he didn't die, and he's able to defeat Cypher. Cypher, I mean, there are debates within Christianity about Judas. Like, would there be a Christ? Would he, if there was no Judas who betrayed Christ and, you know, led to his crucifixion, would we have a Christ? Like, some see Judas as playing a vital role in the Messiah story. Trinity is going to be a big factor for raising up the One. Morpheus. I think there is something funny about this, the One, and maybe there is this subtle subversion of this Messiah idea where it's not just one person that saves everyone, but it's everyone works together and defeats, you know, evil machines or evil or become free working together.
I think that's true. I think that it could be a mob mentality. If everyone says you're the one, I guess you all create that. Together, you get the one by everyone buying into it. I definitely feel like you could read the movie that way. But it's, of course, easier and more fun and easier to project yourself into the role of Keanu if you buy into the fact that he's on the Christ journey, that this is the part of the Passion where he was struggling with his identity and he's got to have a moment where he recognizes who he really is. I don't think Christ had a girlfriend. That part seems new.
Well, William Dafoe did.
Well, yeah, if you want to follow The Last Temptation of Christ, I don't know that many people take that one. That was a little hot button in its era. But there is a similarity here between that film and this one here. I do feel like we're watching a man struggle with a supernatural destiny, and he can't quite buy into it. He's the one that doubts, and so the Oracle has kind of put a mind trick on him so that doubting himself works for him for the time being. But it's Trinity that gets it all turned around, right? Because she's destined to love him, and because she does love Keanu, that must mean he's the one? Does that math add up?
There's a lot of signs to it. I mean, she loved him before this movie ever began. When they were just watching him as green lines on a screen, she loved him. Did she love him because Morpheus thought he was the one? You know, again, is this a self-fulfilling prophecy? The only prophecy that, again, I think really shows foresight was Morpheus is going to be captured. I mean, how would the Oracle know that? But everything else, it's so mumbo jumbo, you believe because you want to.
Right. Like, if you've ever had your palm read or tarot cards or whatever, I mean, yeah, usually that stuff is easy to read between the lines there. And I'm not sure the Oracle said anything that couldn't have been said by a really good fake psychic.
Except for Morpheus being captured.
Yeah, that seemed inevitable.
What I find really interesting is getting back to Smith. We haven't seen him in a while. He comes back. There's this big fight. They capture Morpheus because they want to get, what, access codes to Zion so they could, I don't know, get in there and destroy it. Not really sure what the access codes do.
It's like the doors.
Yeah, garage door code.
Is that what it is? It's just a garage door opener.
It literally, yeah, it's about getting inside physically, because presumably if they can get past the walls, I don't know what they're made of, but apparently not metal, but if they can get past those walls, they can kill all the real humans, and then they'll never have any more insurrections. No one will take any more red pills.
What I love with Smith, he takes out the earpiece. There's something foreboding about that, like he's going to get real with Morpheus now. And he does this, I don't know, it's kind of this cheesy talk about, you know, we first built you this utopia, and you rejected that. I like that part, but then he's like, I've classified humans as viruses. I'm like, whatever. If Smith wasn't doing, like, you know, that great voice and that great performance, I don't know how much I'd enjoy that. But I love this idea, like, when it comes down to it, Smith is like, I want to get out of here. He is trapped. He is a program trapped in the Matrix, too. Like, he's this scent of the Matrix. That's all he can smell, and it disgusts him. Like, there is something really interesting with this character. When I was watching this film again, not knowing the sequels, I didn't read as much into it. I read a lot more into it now, but seeing Smith react this way and, like, here is a program that is grasping onto free will, like, he wants to escape too, which is a neat idea. It's not just the humans that want to escape, it's also these machines that want to get out of there.
This is the scene that makes Smith a great character to me. Is, yes, he has the same problem they do. I mean, it's surprising he doesn't relate more. They all want out of the Matrix. I also get a little bit of racism, though. I mean, the way he's talking about stink and shoving sweat up Lawrence Fishburne's nose and things. I mean, maybe I'm seeing racism where it isn't there. When you have a black man in chains and a white man abusing him and talking about stink, that really comes off as a nasty, nasty thing that makes me hate Smith even more.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Wachowskis would want to portray this Matrix, you know, as this evil capitalistic structure where they had things like slavery, and I think that might be intentional. Not that they're condoning racism, but I think they would want that to be part of the imagery, that being in the Matrix is being a slave.
There's also a bit of Rodney King. Did you get that when they capture Morpheus and, like, all the cops are just nightsticking the hell out of him?
Yeah, I thought they were playing into that whole police brutality against blacks thing there.
Yeah, he even gets a jab in that all the agents look the same. I do feel like they're taking racial epithets and things that are said about one race and spinning it for humor or for irony, however you want to do it. It's something that they're playing with here. It's something they like to do.
But Smith, he is delightfully evil in this, and I forgot how much I liked him. And what this reminded me of was that when the sequel came out, it was Smith more than anybody else. I was so excited came back, and that Mr. Anderson was in the trailer for part two and everything. So yeah, this scene is what sells it to me. The fact that he takes himself offline, he unplugs from his own masters just to torment Morpheus a little bit more. It's pure hatred he has for humans, and that makes it a personal fight. It's better than man versus machine. There's hate here.
You do wonder, if everyone hates it, why don't we all give up on the Matrix? But I guess somebody's going to run the batteries. You know, that's what it ultimately comes down to. Someone's got to be the boss, and someone's got to be the underling. And so it's just something that he has to get through here. But we've now approached that scene that I was hinting at earlier.
My favorite scene of the movie?
No, it is not.
Yeah, it is. I love, love, love this action scene. Tremendous action scene. Great score.
Well, you've changed your mind since the time we watched it in theaters, because I distinctively remember when these two come in and they're cartwheeling in slow motion in air and all of this, someone else in the theater stood up and goes, "That's bad!" And you got up and shouted back at them, "Yeah, as in not good."
I did not.
You did.
I think he may have just been upset about someone interrupting the film.
No. What he was, and I've seen Arnie do this before, is he was getting angrier and angrier that a movie that was better than Star Wars was taking away its glory. You didn't want to like this movie. You wanted the Lucas one to be better.
I have never stood up and yelled in a movie in my life.
You did it, and I watched it. I was there, buddy. And I agreed with you. I thought this was a silly scene.
Again, if you're going to do a crazy action film, yeah, go crazy. I love this scene as far as, you know, it is so absurd. Like the amount of bullets, I love at the end of the firefight, it's just marble dropping down and crashing. I don't know. I think this is an exciting scene. Now it's probably been done 100 times since then.
1,000.
Okay, 1,000. But seeing this for the first time, this is fun action. There's a reason they're doing cartwheels. It's not just because it looks cool, but like they actually have powers where they could flip around and break physics in this world. I like that it's not just looking cool, but there's reasons behind all their flips and cartwheels.
Yeah, I hate the underworld films and that kind of derivative shit. And here, I do think it might be a little bit too much slow-mo. It does kind of kill the inertia a little bit, but I really love the camera work. I love the humor of the falling marble. I love the bullets. I love the techno. I like techno music. It works for me. The whole vibe of this scene, give Keanu a gun and I like it. Give Keanu karate chopping and I don't.
Yeah, can I just play the role here of saying, couldn't they have just brought a chopper instead of guns? If they can just grab whatever they want from the construct and bring it into the Matrix, why not get the chopper rather than shooting their way up to the roof to then steal the chopper that they don't even know how to fly?
Well, here's the thing, Stuart. I do kind of agree with you, because after this big fight, first of all, this is a government building. I would assume it's on lockdown. Like, the agents would be like, don't let anyone in. And here comes two people walking in, like, in trench coats. But I don't get what the bomb is for. I like the punchline when the sprinklers go off and you see the agents all in their nice suits and they just get soaking wet. I don't understand what the bomb actually does, though, besides set off the sprinklers.
I kind of took it as a distraction. Like, it's really just trying to get the agents to look the other way and get a lot of the people out of there so they can get to Morpheus. But you're right. If I think about it any longer than that, it doesn't all quite work out.
We're asked to stop thinking is basically what happens. We're now in Act 3. Neo has accepted that this is his destiny. I don't know that he's accepted that he is the Messiah, but he's accepted that he must go back and do what the Oracle prophesied. And so now it's just, yeah, it's a lot of bullet time. It's a lot of explosions. We're not asked to think too hard about any of the rest of it. And maybe that's fine, but I just didn't like this scene. I actually laugh out loud seeing Keanu flipping in the air. It's just, to me, that's comedy. But for some people, it's cool.
Here's the thing. Like, they get the helicopter and Trinity's flying. Neo's using the rail gun. Like, why is he firing into the room with Morpheus there? Like, how does he know not one of those bullets will hit him? It looks beautiful. Like, again, the cinematography, like, the way the water shooting up when bullets hit it, and the way, like, Agent Smith or one of the other agents goes, like, flying when they're hit. All this stuff looks beautiful. I do think it does start losing some of the ideas or some of the, you know, where other things are more well thought out. Here, it is really just going for that action.
Yeah, that is the one thing where, for me, I mean, I'm completely suspending disbelief. Keanu wants to walk vertically, that's fine. Keanu takes a Gatling gun and destroys everything in a room, but not one bullet hits Morpheus, who's dead center in that room? Bullshit.
And what is that building? Is that the same software company that he worked at?
No, I thought this was some federal building now.
Yeah, they call it a government building.
Okay. I just thought that was a strange way to return to work, but you know, whatever.
Actually, a huge set piece, like a 4-story-tall soundstage that they built with a helicopter on a rig and everything. It was pretty neat to see.
Wow, that's interiors. That's impressive.
Again, talking about how this looks, like all that water they had to be pumping and the way the water runs down the glass. I mean, I don't see how they could have done that with a actual building.
No, it's a gorgeous looking scene, like you said, Jacob. And we really do have like a 45 minute action scene going on here. Because once this last act starts, it does not stop the punching, kicking, shooting, flying, jumping until the credits roll.
Yeah, the helicopter crashing in the building. Again, the way that glass explodes. God damn, I want like that blown up as a poster. Just beautiful looking. And then they run to the subway station and Trinity and Morpheus get out, but now Agent Smith shows up again.
He could have gotten out if she didn't take a moment to talk about her feelings. I mean, this was not the moment.
But you know what? She's like, there's something I have to tell you. Everything the Oracle said come to pass will come to pass. I think she had to slow it down so Neo would die. So the Oracle would be truthful.
But she doesn't know what the Oracle said, so she's not doing that on purpose.
Now, you mentioned this before, and I do want to put this under the microscope. Every now and then, there are people who kind of get a strange look on their face, and they become Agent Smith when Agent Smith dies. He cannot die in the Matrix. He then is reborn instantaneously with a stander by. Are these people that are in a pod somewhere, or are they susceptible to him because they are sinners? Why are these people the hosts for future Agent Smiths?
The way I take it, agents are sentient programs, and so they could overtake these other basically people's brains are downloaded and they're just another program, so they could take that over, and that's how I read it.
Does that kill them? Are they now baby food at that point? I'm only asking you to theorize. We obviously have no knowledge of that. But
yeah, I think they do die, and I think we'll touch upon that in the sequels.
Okay.
I, for some reason, would think he could body hop, and if he body hopped out and they didn't kill Agent Smith, that the body would be fine. But because they kept killing him, then yeah, that's baby food. The question I have, the people I feel bad for, are the security guards that Keanu shot up in the lobby. Because those are just dudes in a pod doing their job.
Well, here's the thing. Like, there's a scene, the woman in the red dress, where Morpheus and Neo are walking around, and Neo learns that anyone could be an enemy. Everyone's our enemy. Like, this is very us versus them, religious fanatic cult talk. Like, if they're not with us, they are against us, and we must treat everyone as an enemy. So yeah, when you're in that lobby shooting these security guards, you know, they're dunking their donuts in a coffee, it does come off pretty brutal. Like, these are people that are brains in a pod. They don't know any better, and you're just shooting them all up because they're not on your team.
And not to dampen the party here, I know we're supposed to be having fun, but this, of course, was the scene that was cited as a blueprint, if you will, for lack of a better word, when the students shot up Columbine, that they were apparently influenced by this movie, and a month later used it dressed like the characters. One gets a little queasy thinking that someone could take it literally the way that they did. So maybe that's why I don't like this scene too. Maybe it's just a nagging sense that there's a reality to it and I can't go with the video game violence the way that I am expected to.
But we finally get it down. It's Agent Smith versus Neo. And you don't like the lobby fight, Stuart. Do you like this one? Because this is, I don't like Kung Fu Keanu, but this one I kind of go with a little bit more than Keanu versus Fishburne.
No, it's because I don't think of Hugo Weaving having any better Kung Fu skills than Keanu Reeves. I just feel like they're actors that have committed. They're really trying, but I'm not rooting for anyone at this point. I'm just kind of hoping it passes by without further embarrassment.
See, and I'm noticing different style. Like, something I like about Weaving, he has a very blunt, brutal style. There's nothing pretty about what he's doing. He is just throwing fists. Like, there's that scene where he kind of just like raises up from his toes and like he's ready to go and just starts punching. I do like that. Again, they have different styles. Again, not great kung fu, but I'm appreciating that I'm seeing real actors pull this off, and it's shot like a kung fu film. They're not doing quick cuts here to hide their inability to do this.
Quite frankly, I'm more excited about what's happening back in the real world, because something we haven't talked about, but there are these mechanical squiddy creatures that are floating around. They don't really do much in this movie. They're sort of the worker bees, if you will. They're responsible for flushing you if you should wake up in your pod.
They look like Rastafarian tadpoles.
Perhaps. But they're finally kicking some ass. They're the ones that are going to be sent in when they get the codes for Zion. And they found the Nebuchadnezzar. Normally, they can just throw a switch and it blows up all of the electronics in the area. But they cannot do that because Neo still is relying on their electronics. They need to get him out of the Matrix before they can throw that switch. This is something they took for Avatar later. I remember that being a good source of tension in Avatar, and it came from this. I now can recognize that.
You know, talking about scenes I don't really like, this is probably the one I dislike the most, is this, okay, I get it, that we gotta have this tension, can Neo get out of the Matrix in time to hit the EMP? I just think these squiddies get there way too early, these Sentinels. Like, they are cutting up that ship. Like, they had to hit a power line at some point and knocked out the power to that thing. They are just cutting that up with their laser beams. They stretch it too long. You know, this is that countdown before the bomb goes off, where it's the time between, you know, 2 seconds and 1 second is eternal.
I agree with you. I think that they get into the ship way too early. The Nebuchadnezzar seems like a big ship, but not so big that a Sentinel's gonna look for you for 5 minutes. And so I think that there should have been more of the Sentinel trying to get in, and then less of, oh my god, the Sentinel is 2 feet from us, let's fire the EMP.
Yeah, we're gonna see in the sequels that these ships have, like, turrets on the outside, and you could shoot bullets at these things. Like, they maybe should have thrown that in there. Have another Star Wars scene where they're sitting in a ship shooting enemy ships.
Yeah, I like that stuff, but I'm more invested in the Neo fight in the Matrix. And finally, after he fought Agent Smith to a standstill, he finally goes on the run, and Smith body hops without dying, and is waiting for Neo and kills him. It is the death.
And did you get why he was in that room? Why he knew Neo was going to go in that room?
No.
That is the heart of the city, room 303, where Trinity started at the beginning of the film. He recognizes it. There's a scene where they pan down the name of that building, and he looks up at it and recognizes it and knows to go to 303, because that's where Trinity had found a line at the beginning.
Oh, okay. So 303 is where you get a really good phone reception for getting out of there. That is their room.
Yeah, that was one of their rooms they used.
Ah, subtle.
Yeah, that was, I wasn't quite clear on, you can't use cell phones to get out. Yeah, it has to be a hard wire.
You'd never get out in 2014.
Exactly. But there were some rules about the phone. I just kind of went with it. It kind of flew over by my head, but
I'm glad they didn't try to get too much into it, because even trying to comprehend, okay, what are they really doing? They just disappear into thin air. Okay, just I'll go with it. Don't try to explain it too much, because then it will hurt.
Right. I'm torn about this conclusion here. On one hand, they're building to it. Lawrence Fishburne in the dojo said something about bullets will one day not affect you. But hasn't he become too powerful at this point?
I think we'll hit that with the sequel. I definitely feel, though, that once he rises from the dead, I think it's a cheat. There's no reason he rises from the dead.
It's the power of love.
Yes, there is a very real reason, and it is super cheesy.
More than the Sentinels, you know, not being able to take out that ship, I think it's the power of love that bugs me so much. I like this idea. Let's subvert this Messiah idea, and it's really a group of people that build a Messiah. You know, again, Eastern philosophy and Eastern religions, these ideas of male and female, the yin and the yang coming together. And you see that with Trinity and Neo. They're the ones who save Morpheus actually together. And here, the resurrection comes because of Trinity. I just don't like that it's because of a kiss. I like the idea, okay, we're going to reverse the Sleeping Beauty myth, and the girl's going to wake the guy up. I wish there was a better scientific or computery programmy reason that this happened than a magic kiss.
Well, they've been building to it, and on some level, they're two stars in a Hollywood movie. They're falling in love. We need to break that sexual tension. But yeah, that this would be the way that he knows that he is the one, because she confirms that love. Didn't he already figure that out? Didn't we all know that? That could hardly feel like a revelation to him. And again, it's a clap for Tinkerbell. It's a E.T. phone home moment. We're supposed to be happy that he's back from the dead. We don't really care whether it's Elliot's tears or whatever brings him back. He's there. And now, yeah, what are they going to do for the sequel? Because he can just wave his hand and bullets drop to the ground harmlessly.
Yeah, and I don't like when he comes back and he's, like, so busy doing his nails while fighting off Smith with one hand. It is too powerful. It's cool when he jumps into Smith. I mean, we've seen Smith do that so often. That's a nice reversal. But the rest of it, it's too much. And the fact that, I mean, this movie ends with him as Superman. Bullets bounce off of him and he can fly.
Yeah, literally. I mean, yeah, flying up into the stratosphere. That last shot is a shocker how much they go for superhero.
What I find interesting, though, is the Matrix isn't destroyed at the end of this film. The Death Star's still around. He didn't destroy it. There is this idea that I've come to free your mind. He's got all these superpowers, but it's almost like I'm going to talk to you and try to convince you and use philosophy and logic to show you the way. And if I have to beat up an agent, now I have superpowers and can do that. But I do find it interesting that the Matrix is still around at the end of this film, that it's more about being a wake-up call to people and not be in this dichotomy where good defeats evil. Evil is still around at the end.
And cynical me takes that as, of course there is, because they want a sequel. I mean, you didn't kill Darth Vader at the end of episode 4.
Yeah, definitely. I didn't realize that the first time I saw this movie, it didn't scream sequel to me. But yeah, now I get very much that there is got to be another chapter. He's just getting started. He just made water into wine, and there's going to be a lot more. Even though he's already crucified and came back, they jump back into the Christ story. I do feel like this is going to be a, for lack of a better word, but or to use the iconography they've been using, a good versus evil, God versus Satan kind of end conclusion. It'll be curious to see how much they can keep incorporating the Christ myth into the sequels now that they've sort of worked through all the major plot points, if you were.
I can't imagine that they can. I mean, you've done the Jesus story. If Neo's still around after Easter, it's no longer Jesus. So the time has come to make a choice. Are you going to choose the red pill or the green pill for the Matrix? Jacob.
You know, I do find this interesting that it came out in 99, same year as The Phantom Menace, because that was obviously the film I was camping out for, and I didn't see The Matrix till after that one. But here's two films that are very similar. Lucas, I know about Joseph Campbell because Lucas has dropped his name so much, but this story is Campbellian to a T, much like A New Hope was. You know, the young boy, the old magic wizard, if you study that hero's journey, it hits it point by point by point by point. The other similarity is special effects. Like this, I think another reason this film really sticks out, maybe the number one reason, is just visually how it looks and the effects and bullet time. But the big difference, by the time Lucas got around to those prequels, got around to Phantom Menace, it almost seemed like those films, they were commercial for his special effects company. And hey, buy these cameras, these digital cameras. And here, the effects seem tied into the story. And that's a good use of special effects. That's a good use of action when it's there to build up the story, just not a reason to be cool. And I think so many times with action films, it's, well, what looks cool? Optimus Prime on a T-Rex. We're going to see that later this summer. Looks cool. How great is that story going to be? But here, all those effects, all that action, more or less, it's not 100% perfect, but it's there to tie into this story, and there's reasons for it. There's reasons why they could do cool martial arts. There's reasons why they're dodging bullets. So I think this film, as an action film, with ideas, it works. I think the Wachowskis delivered on that. And I think there are a lot of neat ideas here. I think as I get older, you know, I kind of see this as like Rage Against the Machine, where when I was 14, they were super awesome and a super way to rebel. And then you get older and you're like, well, they're on a major record label and they're making millions of dollars a year, and yet they're supposedly communists and fighting against capitalism. I don't know. That's kind of how I see that. I think there's some great ideas here to start off a conversation like we've had tonight, like I had tons in college. And I think that's an important piece for a work of art, is that it can start a conversation. So I think this film, it is above that standard action film, above that standard sci-fi film, where maybe at times it comes off as a bit sophomoric or juvenile, but it has ambitions, and for the most part, it reaches those ambitions. So it's not a perfect film, but it's a strong recommend for me.
Stuart.
Yeah, it's a green pill for me. I'll definitely take it. I definitely will watch it. Never had the love that some people do, and it bears repeating that I'm not super obsessed with Star Wars either. I mean, I do think this is Star Wars for the new millennium, whereas Lucas came back and it was all based on nostalgia. Here's something that had really contemporary ideas. I mean, no movie says 1999 more to me than this. A lot of movies had these crazy conspiracies. I've mentioned some of them, but honestly, this is the go-to. For sci-fi in the 90s, this is the first one I would point to. Not my favorite, but the best example of 90s science fiction. I think that the ideas that it traffics in, the action, the technology, everything that it uses, I think its mass appeal is evident and well documented. I think people can take what they want to. I think you said it right, Jacob. This is an action movie with some good ideas in it. I wish it had a few more of the ideas and a little less of the action. That's my personal taste. I feel like they kind of, I don't know, sell themselves a little short by doing too much John Woo. But these are quibbles. It's obviously a good movie, and I recommend it.
And I'm also going to give it a green pill. I don't remember, truthfully, yelling at anyone in a theater that it was terrible, but I understand why I rebelled against it. And it's because I hate things that I feel are ham-handed or too obvious. I feel the Jesus metaphor here is eye-rollingly obvious. I feel the rebirth metaphor is very obvious. I feel some of the dialogue is obvious. I feel Kung Fu Keanu just doesn't work in the dojo scene specifically. I do like the vibe of the film. I love the cinematography. I love the use of reflection. And watching this in the home theater, I could not help but try to catch the camera in Morpheus's glasses, in all the mirrors. Somewhere there had to be a lighting rig. I couldn't find one. I just love all the use of reflection in this. It's a great looking film. It has some good action. Not always great, but very good. It has ideas, and okay, I guess we can pat it on the back for having some. I don't know exactly that any of these ideas are incredibly original. Not that they necessarily have to be. I mean, you go back to Campbell, Hero of a Thousand Faces. That whole point is it is unoriginal. It speaks to a universal appeal. I think they went too obvious with their Jesus. I really do think that. I think that a little bit of subtlety would have been a very nice thing. I rankle that you call this Star Wars for a New Millennium, Stuart, because first of all, while I do believe this film had a long-lasting impact, I think that the 15 years of cinema that have come since The Matrix, the influence is still very evident, although I like to think that it's more refined, except for in the Underworld and Resident Evil films, which are just a pure aping. But it is not a Star Wars. I mean, this does not have the generational love. This does not have, and really, it doesn't. What it doesn't have is two good sequels. We're going to talk about that. But Star Wars, yeah, I mean, it had Episode 4 that got better with Episode 5 and culminated with the orgasmic Episode 6, which may not have been actually all that great, but everybody was so ready for it. Here, it was one movie that spoke to a time, that spoke to a moment, but it didn't speak to a generation. I think it's a really good movie. I like it a lot. I have a lot of fun watching it. I enjoyed this debate of some of the ideas and looking into it. I think that it's a great jumping off point to actually get to real ideas, real philosophy, real religion, and study that stuff instead of just studying the Wachowski synthesizing of it into this kind of a puree style, pseudo-intellectual thing. But yeah, it's a good movie. I recommend it. 3 for 3. But before we get to those sequels, which I remember not liking, and I don't know that I know anyone who does like them, although, Jacob, you're the fan here. I'm looking forward to talking about them. But before that, I was so excited for Part 2 coming off of Part 1 that I remember there were cartoons.
I remember there was one. It was before a Stephen King film, I believe.
Dreamcatcher. Yeah, we're not going to get to review that until we're like 80. And I didn't go to the theaters to see the Matrix animation, but they all came out on a DVD, the Animatrix. And it took place between Matrix and its sequel, and we're going to be reviewing that next week for you donors. And I just want to say thank you to the donors. Welcome to the donation series. We didn't say it at the top of the podcast. We were really anxious to talk about a good movie. But thank you so much for your support. Without you, we couldn't do the show we do every single week. This is our way of saying thank you. We're not selling you this show. We're saying thank you for supporting us and allowing us to do the 52 other shows we do a year.
Yeah, and all those shows would be Stephen King movies I don't want to watch. So I really do want to thank you for giving me a reprieve with a good movie that I haven't seen in a long time. And I don't know anything about the Animatrix. I'm game for it. Not always up for the Disney animation, but I like adult Japanimation. I like manga, so let's go for it. Animatrix, here we go.
So until next time, Tank, I need an exit.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
Once again, thank you for your support of Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this episode in the Now Playing The Matrix retrospective series.
What was said was for you, and for you alone.
Your support helps keep Now Playing on the air.
You're my savior, man. My own personal Jesus Christ.
The Matrix films are the property of Warner Brothers Pictures, and no infringement is intended. Now Playing Podcast is not affiliated with the makers or distributors of these films.
You give me that juris my diction crap, you can cram it up your ass.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Not everyone believes what you believe.
My beliefs do not require them to.
Now Playing's The Matrix retrospective series is a Venganza Media production. Copyright 2014. All rights reserved. And no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Goodbye, Mr. Anderson.
Yeah, one of the thing the Wachowski brothers, can we call them the brothers in this film?
Yeah, they are the brothers until after The Matrix. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we're going to call them the brothers till Jupiter's ascending. All the way through, he calls Neo Mr. Anderson.
I used to have a therapist that spoke to me in that way, and I would just laugh and laugh internally because I'd be like, you don't know that you're the evil guy from Matrix. I didn't tell him anything. No way. And this was a kickoff, right? This was before not Laura Palmer. This is before Laura Croft. I mean, we've definitely seen ass-kicking women before. Sigourney Weaver, Linda Hamilton. James Cameron is known for this.
Rene Russo in Lethal Weapon 4.
Well, I don't want to talk about that. But you're ruining my point. But
I think it did open a door for those other movies that you mentioned in the early 2000s. I think that without The Matrix, Angelina Jolie might not have been as popular as she was.
What? Did this film give her big breast? Is that why?
Hey, she was going topless in Foxfire around this point.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it wasn't till Laura Croft that she became super popular.
Well, she did win an Oscar in between there, but I'm not sure that point. She won an Oscar this year, in fact.
Oh, girls.
Girl Interrupted.
Girl Interrupted. Yeah. You're right. All right. I was far more focused in this scene on Troy's dialogue.
Who?
If you go back to one of our early podcasts, Back to the Future, I kind of
Wait, I'm stopping you. You said Troy.
Yeah.
You got to say who he is.
I said his customer.
Who are you talking about?
The guy who bought the discs.
Oh, that was his name?
Yeah, Troy.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I thought it was Reinhardt.
It's Troy.
That was his last name and Troy was his first
name. Oh, I wrote down the last name. Okay.
I didn't write anything about him.
I think that message might have been even heavier if they had had Will Smith instead of Keanu Reeves. Although he's too cocky for me. I couldn't imagine him ever self-doubting himself.
I just would have loved the Matrix rap song since he was writing songs for all his movies back then.
That's right. Men in Black, God. Wild Wild West.
Oof. Leave those Stevie Wonder riffs alone. Stop it, man. I'm so glad he's not doing music anymore. I don't think he's doing acting anymore. I never see him.
After Earth, he won a Razzie last year.
Oh, God. 2014. I'll go with that. So they... Hold on, I got a plane.
Someone's got a plane, yeah.
Yeah. Can you hear that cat?
There's a dog or cat.
It's a cat, yeah. Really?
What really?
That cat. It's just ridiculous.
Did you get some deja vu? Did it walk by twice?
It did. It did.
I can't believe you still have that cat. I thought it was dying.
Yeah, years ago. And yet, it can't die. It has too much to hate. Who he really is. I don't think Christ had a girlfriend. That part seems new.
Harvey Keitel did.
Harvey Keitel? He was Judas.
Oh, I thought he was Jesus.
No, Willem Dafoe.
No, that was Will. Are you kidding me? Harvey Keitel? He could never be anyone's Jesus.